Hello everyone, how are you this morning? A few more stragglers, but I think we should probably kick off. My name is Liana Hosier. I am a multimedia journalist with the BBC, and I took a couple of years off to come to Michigan University and look at water rights here in Flint and elsewhere in the United States, in Arizona, New Mexico. So we're talking about, is water a human right? I'll just lay out the problems and then introduce the panel guests and where they'll kick off. So access to clean water, obviously, as we know, a growing problem. The UN says that by 2030, demand will outstrip supply by 40%. NASA's GRACE satellite showed the depletion of the world's aquifers from overuse, damming, the stresses of climate change exacerbating that. Then, of course, you've got the pollution of water, with studies showing microplastics, for example, in well, almost all American tap water, and of course across the world as well. You know, there's the problems of chemicals and heavy metals from industrial agricultural waste and our aging infrastructure. There's also the affordability issue. Water rates in America have increased by 40% since 2010, and according to Michigan State University report, in 5 years' time, 36% of households in America won't be able to afford water, as water rates are just soaring. So we have a problem. Is the solution making water a human right to ensure that equitable distribution and pollution regulation? If water is a human right, how is that going to work? Is it the most practical and effective way to solve the problem? If not, what kind of society are we creating, or what are the alternatives to deal with these problems? So we've got Eric Olson here working for the NRDC, and Nakia Wakes, Flint resident, Josiah Neely from the oh, sorry, from R Street Institute down in the Southwest. And then lawyer Winona Singer from Michigan State, working on an international level and also indigenous law. And I thought we'd start off with Nakia, because you are from Flint and you have lived this experience. And I think it would be very helpful to kind of start off with hearing what it's been like for you.
Yes. Hello, everyone. Access to clean, safe, and affordable water is a human right. At least it should be. We need water to survive. So what right do we have to tell another human being, no, you can't live because you can't afford to pay water? This usually starts a debate, except here in Flint, where we live in the Great Lakes State and we do not have access to clean water. Even though we pay the highest rates in the United States for what comes out of our taps, and if you cannot afford your monthly water bill in Flint, which is 8 times the national average, your contaminated water is shut off, which can lead to foreclosure of your home, serious illness, shame, and so much more. So now, because a profit is valued over people in Michigan, Flint residents have to find ways to pay hundreds of dollars a month for their water bills just to keep their poison on. Then they have to wait in line for hours, hoping the help centers does not run out before they can pick up 4 cases of water. We feel it is safe, 4 cases of water they feel is safe, or find the money to load up on cases for their everyday needs. Or for too many that can't afford or can't do any of that, and their water is shut off. Over the winter, families had to melt snow just to flush the toilet. They collected rainwater to bathe. They had to ration flushes. And for some reasons, people wonder why we have hepatitis A outbreaks, and yet water is still being turned off block by block in Flint and Detroit, Michigan. They tell people to wash their hands to avoid getting sick, but how are they supposed to do that when the city turned off their water? And the state of Michigan decided to stop providing bottled water to the Flint residents. We haven't figured that one out yet, neither. In my case, and for so many other Flint residents, my 2 children had high levels of lead, and their lives changed forever because our government thought that we didn't deserve clean water like the cities surrounding us. The state of Michigan decided that Flint did not have a right to safe, high-quality water that matches the high rates we are paying. But what's worse, our government also felt my twins did not have a right to be born. And not just one set of precious twins, but two. I was drinking the contaminated water and was pregnant, and both times lost both of my twins. Twice I felt the lives inside of me end because someone else decided that Flint residents had no right to clean, safe, and affordable water. So we drank what we had, which turned out to be deadly and damning for so many people. I don't wish this on anyone, but people need to wake up. Clean, safe, and affordable water is something most of us take for granted every day. When you grab a glass of water, when you're thirsty, you brush your teeth after eating or rinsing your food before cooking, with that's right, water. You have no idea how much you use water until it is taken away. But as long as water is treated like a commodity and traded for profit instead of being valued as a basic human right, almost everyone is in danger of finding out the hard way. So when people argue that access to clean, safe, and affordable water is not a human right, I ask them, what right do you have to take away one of the most basic survival requirements from someone else? Who are you to decide who gets to live or die? Thank you.
Thank you, Nakia. That's very moving. And I wanted to bring in Eric now because you actually were, you know, working on the legal settlement here in Flint. But I'll let you make your statement.
Okay. I'll actually be brief because I think the questions and answers will be interesting. I'm Eric Olson. I oversee health and food programs at the Natural Resources Defense Council. We are a nonprofit with about 3 million members and supporters across the country. I'm in our Washington, D.C. office. I just wanted to talk a little bit about the concept of the human right to water, because it is embodied now in a United Nations General Assembly resolution that the United States actually abstained on. But the human right, there is a human right to water and sanitation that's enshrined in that document. A few states have picked this up. So far, not clearly enforceable. California was the first to explicitly adopt a human right to water. Several other states, Pennsylvania and others, have constitutional provisions that cover water. Michigan, we are looking at right now. There is a constitutional measure provision that speaks about water protection. It hasn't really been enforced. And there are several other states that have similar provisions. Michigan also has an MEPA, Michigan Environmental Protection Act, that includes some provisions that will be very interesting to try to take a look at. I do want to talk about the fact that it's pretty clear that we don't right now have safe and affordable drinking water across the country. NRDC has done a series of reports, including one last year, that showed that over 27 million people have water that violates the basic EPA health standards. And far more than that, tens of millions more, their water isn't tested to determine if it's safe or not. And we found in some places, for example, in Puerto Rico, 99% of the population before the hurricanes actually were served by systems violating the Safe Drinking Water Act. So there's widespread violations, very little enforcement by EPA or by the states. And we do know that Flint obviously has an extraordinary lead contamination problem. NRDC, representing many citizens in Flint, sued. We reached a settlement agreement for about $100 million to replace the lead service lines in Flint. And we recently sued in Newark, which had comparable problems, Newark, New Jersey. And we are actually, we have an argument in that case coming up in the next couple weeks. The city just filed a brief basically arguing that lead in drinking water isn't necessarily linked to lead in blood. So that's a widespread problem of lead. And I'll just, the one other thing that I think is worth mentioning is there are a lot of contaminants in drinking water that are not regulated at the federal level. So EPA regulates roughly 100 contaminants out of the 80,000 or so that chemicals that have been cleared for use in the United States. and just three that are widespread that we know about. One is these Teflon toxins, perfluorinated and polyfluorinated chemicals, which are showing up, we know, in at least 6 million people's drinking water above EPA-determined safe levels, but they are not regulated. Legionella, which is a very widespread bacteria that's showing up in drinking water all over the country. Perchlorate, which is a component of rocket fuel and munitions, which is in more than 15 million people's drinking water, not regulated. So there are many other common contaminants not regulated. We would like to see a human right to water enshrined in federal law and in state law, and we're looking at various legal actions that can be taken potentially to enshrine that through case law, but obviously the real need is to have statutory or constitutional provisions that actually enshrine it into constitution and statute. Thanks.
Thank you. Josiah, do you think that's the kind of the way forward, or what is your thoughts
sure.
on this?
Sure. And excuse me, I'm getting over a cold, so my voice is a little hoarse. I think that the question that when we talk about should water be recognized as a human right, the question you have to ask is, to what extent is that actually going to improve access to water and clean quality drinking water? And that, I think, is not so clear. Of course, there are many examples. I mean, the UN, you mentioned the UN, the UN Declaration of Human Rights was originally passed, I think, 70 years ago. Many of the rights enshrined to that are regularly flouted, right, even to this day. And so the simple fact that you say that something is a human right or a basic human right or fundamental human right or whatever, that doesn't necessarily mean that people have whatever it is. In addition, when you're talking about being able to get people need to have access to clean drinking water or whatever, that requires positive costs in terms of infrastructure, requires costs in terms of filtering. That's fine, but that raises the question of how do you pay for that, who pays for that, what structures do you have to make sure that that happens? None of those questions are answered by defining water as a human right. They're left open, and those are key important questions. There's also similarly questions of allocation. We've been talking about mostly in terms of drinking water for personal use, bathing, you know, home use, that sort of thing. But an awful lot of water gets used in agriculture, for example. It's very important. There's industrial uses. How you allocate water between those different sectors is a very big and complicated question. Whether you consider water a human right or not, that doesn't answer. It's still left open out there. Finally, what I would say is I do think, and this is something that was recognized by UN at Kyoto, and it's been recognized other places, that there does, I believe, need to be a significant role for the market in terms of allocating water between different uses and then also finding the funding for that. That doesn't rule out, obviously, a role for government regulation in terms of safety standards or even public provision in some cases or assistance for people who couldn't otherwise afford water, I do think that it plays an important role, and I do think in some cases, when you're talking about the lawsuit, it's easier, generally speaking, to hold a private company liable for damage that they do to you than it is the government, because the government has sovereign immunity. They get to set the rules for when you can sue them and how much you can recover. So in that sense, there is trying to say, well, we'll just, if you're going to just make water a human right, and then the government would take care of it. Obviously, the government doesn't always do a good job, and it can be hard to hold them accountable in some ways. So I'm sure we can talk more about some of those points as the conversation goes forward, but I don't want to go on too long either. So.
Thank you. Winona Sigal, do you want to put your response forward?
Sure. I think that while it's true that the UN General Assembly's adoption of a resolution affirming that water, a right to water and a right to sanitation are human rights, while that's aspirational and it does not necessarily mean that people will automatically have access to clean, safe water, at the same time, it's absolutely critical and can be very mobilizing. It helps communities to frame their interests and push for and demand access to clean water, knowing that it's been affirmed and embraced as a human right. And furthermore, it also focuses attention on those communities around the world and in the United States where there is an abject deprivation of access to clean water. And so knowing, because of the UN General Assembly's embracing of a human right to water and sanitation, there are groups around the world working to identify those communities that are absolutely lacking in the greatest with the greatest statistical lack of access to clean water. And so in the United States, for example, we've responded to the recognition of a human right to clean water and sanitation by identifying those counties in the United States where there are the lowest household rates of access to clean water and sanitation. And in fact, in the lower 48, states, those areas are on Indian reservations. They include the Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota and the Navajo Reservation at that portion that is in eastern Arizona. And it's absolutely critical and helpful to identify those communities with abject deprivation of access to water, where one in three households lacks access to water, where the cost of water due to the need to haul waters to communities is exponentially greater than the cost of access to water to non-Indian communities that surround those reservations. On the Navajo Reservation, if a household that lacks access to water can spend up to $40,000 a year or have an expense of that amount to rely on hauling water, whereas a community outside the reservation that does have the distribution infrastructure to provide water to its household will spend only hundreds of dollars in a year for that same access to that same quantity of water. Framing water as a human right helps us to identify these gross inequities in our country and around the world. And so I believe that it is absolutely helpful to do so.
I want. Do you have questions for each other, or shall I jump in and ask a question? You brought up a good point of who pays. So does someone want to take that up? Who's going to pay for this $1 trillion? Is that $1 trillion for a new infrastructure, or how is this? How is making it a human right going to help?
Yeah, I'll take a crack at that. So American Water Works Association has estimated that it's going to cost in excess of $1 trillion to upgrade our water infrastructure over the next couple decades. I would say two things about that. Obviously, ratepayers are going to have to, if they can afford it, are going to have to pay some of that cost. But there is really an urgent need for the federal government to step in. There's actually legislation that just passed the House of Representatives and is pending before the Senate and may pass in the next few days that would invest billions of dollars into water infrastructure. That is a drop in the bucket compared to $1 trillion, but at least it's some movement forward. That money doesn't come out of trees. That's taxpayer dollars. But I do feel that there is an urgent need for additional federal resources, especially for low-income communities. And for, I think, Indian reservations are a great example. The colonias along the border of the U.S. and Mexico, many cities in the industrial Midwest have very urgent needs. So, you know, I think those communities really do need federal assistance. And we're actually working on a report that will be coming out in the next 6 months or so that's going to identify state by state, community by community, county by county, what areas have the most serious problems and how that's associated with race in particular, which we think is pretty clear.
You talk about the market being the answer. I mean, that's a lot of money for the market to come up for, which is potentially not a hugely profitable commodity.
Water's not a potentially hugely profitable.
Well, it might segregate.
When you're talking about people spending $40,000 a year because they don't have the distribution infrastructure, you know, from a business point of view, that's a potentially a big profit opportunity that's there if you can get water to them in a way that they don't have to pay that $40,000 anymore. That I think there is a lot of money to be made. And we know, for example, that there is a lot of private capital to build infrastructure in other areas. Another, you know, related issue that probably a lot of people in the audience know about is, you know, natural gas pipelines or whatever. There's no shortage of capital that is available to build that infrastructure privately. Some folks, you know, probably even think, you know, it's too much, right? So I think that, you know, the question is, okay, clearly private capital is out there. Are there ways to provide the incentives for private industry to allocate that capital to water infrastructure? And if they can make money off of it, the answer is absolutely yeah.
And Nakia, how much has your water bills been?
Our water bills, before we even run water, my bill is like probably $80. Before I even run it. When I get my water bill, it's like $100 and something, and I'm barely even using
a month.
Water. Yes,
You got cut off, didn't you?
Yes.
How long were you cut off from your water, and how much was your bill?
My bill was past $2,000 because I refused to pay for poison. We had been lied to all of these years that they were saying there's nothing wrong with the water. We were paying for poison, so. When Governor Snyder came out in 2016 with we had lead in our water, I quit paying my water bill. I told them I refused to pay for poison. I've lost two kids. Both of my kids had high levels of lead. I will flush my toilet with the bottled water.
Isn't that a bit of a problem, you know, when you're, you know, you companies want a return on investment, but water bills are still unaffordable? Sorry.
Yeah, I'm not sure these mics are actually on.
No, they don't actually amplify. They're just recording. Yeah.
Sorry.
So I'd like to comment. One, with regard to focusing on the economic opportunity that might present itself by a household that requires hauling water or that does not have access to water distribution within the home, that denies or neglects the fact that homes that don't have direct access to clean, safe drinking water for household use and that rely on hauling water have six times the number of visits and significantly greater costs to local health to hospitals and to health clinics because the rate of infectious disease experienced by households that don't have direct access to clean, safe water is significantly higher simply because it is critical for bathing, for cleaning one's hands when using the restroom, for cooking. And so to focus on how hauling water can present an economic opportunity seems to neglect the fundamental public health consequences of not having direct access to water. Also, with regard to looking at the economic decision of whether it's a worthwhile investment to expand delivery infrastructure to a household. Oftentimes, the lens that is used to analyze whether that's a worthwhile investment looks at the cost of expanding the distribution network to a household versus how much that household will be spending on the consumption of water. And for communities that are in remote areas, such as on Indian reservations, many reservations in the United States, that economic cost benefit analysis is going to show that it's not economically worthwhile. But perhaps we need to look much more broadly at the economic context of these communities, where, for example, on the Navajo Reservation, water consumption is used within the reservation to provide for, it's an essential part of coal mining, and it's been an essential part of uranium mining. And furthermore, the coal that's produced on the Navajo Reservation powers power plants, which in addition to providing electricity for Las Vegas and California and Arizona, are also powering the pumps of the Arizona Central Water Project. And they're actually they're powering and making it economically possible for water to be diverted from the Colorado River to provide access to clean water for the city of Tucson and other residents in Arizona. So when you look at that broader economic lens, if there's enough resources within the reservation so that water can be provided throughout this area of the Southwest outside the reservation, then surely there must be economically possible to provide distribution infrastructure for water for those households on the reservation, which are just a small fraction relative to the number of households that receive water outside the reservation because of the coal that's produced and its capacity to fuel the power plants that power the Central Arizona Water Project. So I think that sometimes we have to adjust how we're willing to look at the economics of the situation. Are we looking at this just on the household level and the cost of providing water to that household, or are we willing to look at the broader context and look at the economic justice of that broader context, which has led to abject deprivation of water on reservations, but at the same time has extracted resources from a reservation to provide access to water outside the reservation.
Say one thing on that, because I think you raise a good point. And one issue that that we have in terms of water, particularly surface water, is that water rights are typically focused on a particular use, right? So the water that is going to for that coal plant, when it was purchased, that's mining water or power generation water is allocated. If someone is using water to grow alfalfa or almonds, their water is designated agricultural water, right? And it is difficult for water that is being used for one type of use to be transferred to another type of use. It can be done, but there's a really long regulatory process that goes on, and it's costly, it's time consuming. And as a result, water tends to be trapped in one use where perhaps it would be much better off if some of that water was to go to the reservations or for municipal uses or whatever. In California, when they had a drought, when they had the recent drought, lots and lots of water was still being used to grow water-intensive crops, while a lot of folks in cities were facing severe water restrictions. And if you penciled out the math, actually it would have been just a dollar or two a month more to take all that for them to not have the people in the cities to not have the water restrictions and just take some of the water from the almond growers and sell it to the cities. You can't do that because there are barriers in place. So that, I think, is a significant problem that needs to be addressed. And that's part of the reason why I think you don't have water flowing more easily to some of these more high-value uses.
I also want to throw out, you know, if anyone has any questions, please, you know, kind of ask questions and, you know, participate. Does anyone have any questions so far? Yes.
Hi, my name is Randy Loftus. I'm a freelance journalist and a teacher at the University of North Texas. Eric, last fiscal year, the Trump administration tried to eliminate funding for the Rural Utility Service, the USDA, which, if you don't know, that provides grants and loans to small communities all over the country that have water and sewer problems. Was that attempt to eliminate it, was that just let's cut everything, or was there a philosophical belief behind that?
Yes, so the Rural Utility Service, they put about $500 million a year into local, mostly rural, obviously, water and sewer projects. They zeroed it out in last year's budget. Congress refused to zero it out. I think that there are two reasons for that. One is there's definitely a philosophical belief among some in the administration and the Office of Management and Budget that it's not the government's role to be funding these things, that it ought to be funded by the local communities. And I think there's also just, frankly, a hostility to federal investment in some of these communities, which is counterintuitive since a lot of the voting support for the administration came from these communities. So it, to me, it was a big surprise to see that zero budgeting of the Rural Utility Service by a proposal by the Trump administration. But, you know, I think we'll expect a repeat again when this next budget comes out.
How is the free market going to deal with issues of affordability, though? I'd be interested to...
Competition tends to drive down prices. When you talk about the water prices in Flint being 8 times the national average, I would be interested to see, you know, why that is and, what sort of inefficiencies are in the current system that could be eliminated. And, you know, it's possible, I think, that you could get the water bills much, much cheaper.
I mean, did you want to talk about that and maybe a little bit about the lack of the tax base as big city
really,
kind of dies?
Yeah. Right. I really don't even know what to say about that. Like I said, we're paying well over what we should be paying for poison water. I'm not a water expert. I'm just a Flint resident. But
the city over the years has kind of, you know, shrunk as people kind of left and moved to the suburbs as you have this smaller.
Yes, there has been some people that has left, but then some people can't leave. I mean, I get that all the time. Why don't you leave? We are low poverty here. I have 2 children that I have to take care of. I just cannot just up and move. And then even if I did up and move, we're still going to have from the exposures of the lead, we're still going to have problems wherever we move to. And then wherever I do move to, I've lost trust in the government, so I don't even trust their water. This is happening all over the world.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Also, if you're receiving services as a Flint resident, medical or whatever other services, through the programs that they have available for the people that were exposed to the lead, if you move outside of Genesee County,
you can't
it
get that.
More difficult. Outside of the state, you don't get them at all.
And also, I think it's absolutely the wrong question to ask about tax base paying for water. What we're paying for, as Nikia rightly pointed out, is we're not paying for water.
Right.
We're paying for water services and fees and sewer services and fees. We actually have 4 cards on our water bill.
Right.
My water bill is almost $300 a month, right? So that's higher than my mortgage, which my water bill is actually higher than my mortgage. I live with a resident. And those fees are paying for bondholders for JP Morgan. So it's not a matter of having a tax base to provide the money for the water services. This these are illegal charges that have been exerted on the city, and also under financial emergency management, where our democracy has been completely taken away from us. So against the will of the citizens, against the wills of the taxpayers, we do not want to pay these fees. Like Akia said, you're paying money for your water bill even before a drop comes through your pipe. So even if you're not using it, you can have your house shut down and you're still getting water bills.
So is making water a human right going to solve some of these problems, Eric?
Well, just saying that water is a human right alone won't do anything, right? You need to have that be an enforceable right, and you need to know who's going to enforce it against who. So I think Flint is a great example where, you know, we do have a Safe Drinking Water Act that theoretically is supposed to protect citizens and make sure their water is safe, and it was not working, and it's still not working yet. I think that there's a real complexity here, though, because affordability is not enshrined in federal law right now for drinking water. It should be. I think one of the concerns here in many communities is that there is a huge economic need for investment in the water infrastructure. Private equity is not going to go into a lot of these communities because they can't make money off of it. So you've got to figure out some way to support those communities. The Rural Utility Service that we mentioned earlier helps with some rural communities. For cities like Flint, and there are hundreds of other cities where they've lost a lot of tax base, they've lost a lot of citizens, they are paying off bonds that might have been floated years ago that they can't afford to continue paying off. That's where you really need you know, I think the federal government ultimately is going to need to help those communities. And the small amount of money that Congress is about to allocate is a really tiny down payment on that. We really need a much larger investment. Well, are you questioning, like, the capitalist model, or, I mean, have you?
Always, but, I mean, that's... irregardless of that, yes, I'm a socialist, and I think capitalism needs to be destroyed. But even working within the capitalist system, they're not even working within their own rules.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I mean, are we barking up the wrong tree, Winona? Is there another way of looking at this? I mean, maybe this is slightly left field, but in New Zealand, they made the third largest river of New Zealand. They gave it the rights of a human. So if any harm comes to that river, then it's the same as if it happens to the tribe. And yeah. I think it's only been in law since last year, so I'm not sure what kind of practice has come under, but that's a completely different approach, so I don't know what you have to say to that.
Well, from I'm Anishinaabe. I'm a Little Traverse Bay Band tribal member, Odawa from Michigan, and we do have an absolutely different perspective that water is sacred, water is life, water is fundamental to our to religion, to spirituality, and water has its own spirit. And we have a relationship with water where that's not one of conqueror versus the conquered, or not one of exercising dominion over the land, or not one of exercising ownership over a commodity, but rather one of a relationship of kinship. And this is filtered throughout ceremonies. We have ceremonies for the water. We have teachings, sacred teachings about the water that teach us about our responsibility of what to care for the water properly and to ensure that it's available for our communities and for everyone. And also recognizing the way in which we are fundamentally connected to the water. So in Anishinaabe culture, women have special responsibilities with respect to caring for the water and teaching about the water. And we're taught that when a woman is pregnant, she's gestating a child inside this placenta with water, that the water is released when the child is born. Water is at the beginning of life, and water is coursing through us in our bodies. We are mostly made up of water, and on the earth we see the water as veins of the earth, of a living being with its own spirit. And so it's a fundamentally different notion that it's not something to control or conquer, but rather it's something to protect and respect and to teach our next generation to do the same. So,
well, does anyone have any questions at this point? Yes.
I have a question about coverage of the crisis here. Canada, so we obviously got coverage of the crisis worldwide, but wondering local coverage and just the mainstream media coming in when it was a huge deal like a year or so ago. For NACA, like, what do you think that they did right? What do you think they did wrong?
No, they did not do right. They came in, and I mean, I've talked with several news medias, and they come in and then they leave, and it's like it's over with. I've had people call me like, Flint's back together, and I'm like, no, it's been over 1,600 days right now, and we still do not have clean, safe drinking water. That is ridiculous.
I'd like to try and keep to topic, though. Does anyone have any other questions or? Mm-hmm. it's a case of, you know, where government spends its money. I don't, did you want to comment on anything?
I think we've covered it.
Okay. Any other?
The 13th and 14th Amendments were ratified as declarations of human rights without any infrastructure in place for putting them into practical use. What would happen, what would have to happen in the United States if we declared water to be a human right? What would need to follow to make that an enforceable right?
Well, I'll take a crack at that. When the post-Civil War amendments were adopted, there had to be implementing laws to implement them. And one of the laws that's still in use is Section 1983, which basically allows citizens to sue states or other actors who act under color of state law for violating those amendments. So, you know, there is authority under federal statutory law to enforce those constitutional amendments, and you would need, you know, just declaring something a right without executing laws really doesn't help you very much. So that would need to be adopted. The other thing, I wanted to respond to what was just suggested about privatization and affordability. I think there needs to be a basic level of water supply for human needs that is just assumed to be, you know, affordable at a very affordable rate for everyone before you start piling on lawn and other uses. So basic use is really critical, and having some kind of affordability rate structure is really important to start at that level. And then, you know, if you want to water your lawn or you want to have a swimming pool or you want to use it for other uses, well, you can pay for that. But in a lot of communities, we don't have affordability rate structures now.
Did you have a question?
Yes. Yeah, I'm with East Village Magazine here in Flint, and one thing we've written about a lot in recent years is how the whole water crisis has destroyed trust in the system. And what are your thoughts on what it would take to restore that trust? Because we're at the point now where even when the experts say things are okay or they're getting better, nobody believes them.
Been
lied to over so many years.
Right.
Any thoughts on what it takes to restore trust after so many years of distrust?
I agree with Laura, a Flint resident. We've been lied to for so long. That's part of the reason why I quit paying my water bill. We had been complaining about this way before they came out with the lead exposures. We had bottled waters. It was brown, muddy-like water, and they were saying we were lying then. So they just need to stop lying. For one, it's not even the lead that we have to worry about here in Flint. There's other heavy metals, other heavy carcinogens that's in our water. My lead in my house was 1,100 parts per billion. They have changed the leaded pipes from the street, but what about the rest of my pipes coming through my house? It's still lead in there. There's no way y'all can tell me because you changed my pipes, it's safe for me to drink. Yeah, right. I'm not drinking that water. It is not safe. They need to stop.
So they need to replace home piping?
Yes, I think they need to replace the whole home, everything. I've had my water heater tested, and that is where the Legionella disease, that's where all of that and everything sits in. Nobody, Mark Edwards, nobody is testing water heaters. I mean, people are losing them, went through 3-4 water heaters in their homes. All of that is coming through the pipes. They've moved it from the street, but not the house. So how is it safe for me to drink my water now because they moved my pipes? It is not safe at all.
Is there any hope of home pipe replacement?
I know there's ongoing litigation right now. And actually, I think there's a 1983 case that's been filed. So we'll see. I think it's very challenging because there isn't currently any certainly under the Safe Drinking Water Act, there's not an explicit authorization to pull out pipes from people's houses. But I think there's something called tort law that there may be an opportunity to do that if action by the city or by the water utility has caused damage inside the home, which is the allegation, or has caused contamination. That's the allegation, and we'll see if they succeed in that. I don't know how to guess.
Yes.
Can you point to any example where it may well be outside the United States, where a country or another, there's a set of what you would point to as exemplary of accounting for water as a human right and then putting the structure in place to actually make it affordable? So you're meshing the aspirational with actually organizational sort of on the ground system. Is there anything like that, or is this, we're all in the same boat?
Do you know of any countries?
I'm not aware that any country has really fully enshrined it and actually executed it. A lot of countries, South Africa, other countries, have adopted laws that say this, but actually fully executing it is very challenging, and I'm not aware that.
South Africa has huge problems of segregation of clean water to those who can afford it.
Right.
Though there are other countries where there are, you know, I've just come back from Iceland, all the water is clean wherever it comes from and free, but though everything else is extremely expensive. Yes?
In California, the legislation that confirmed water as a human right is in many communities considered MRGA. It never quite reaches the ground. Could you talk about how that is playing out in California?
Yeah, well, the California statute, the question was about the California law that enshrines water as a human right. The problem is that it's really not, so far has been read to not be directly enforceable. So if you can't directly enforce it, it's nice language, but, you know, we would like to see the courts interpret that as enforceable. We would like to see stronger laws adopted and maybe even a constitutional amendment, and there's a lot of discussion of trying to do that.
We don't know, are there any tribal governments talking about making water a human right?
So in terms of, there are tribes that are very active in recognizing human rights, and the Navajo Nation, for example, has a very active human rights commission, and there have been I know that there have been also tribes that have formed intertribal agreements with regard to recognizing that they each have a shared responsibility as with regard to resources and the environment, including water. But I'm not aware of specific examples of the kind that you're asking about.
And has that had an impact on the ground? Or?
I think that it influences policy for the tribal governments with regard to, you know, recognizing the need to collect data about access to water for tribal communities, and also to prioritize ensuring that any tribal reserve water rights are pursued, and that opportunities for leveraging resources to provide for the money needed to develop infrastructure for distribution and delivery of water, that's available. So it can influence policy, but I'm not more aware of more concrete details than that.
Other people had questions? Yes. Did you have ideas?
Of
what is it? No. Yeah.
If I could just comment on that, because it in the discussion, it seems like there are a number of different existing long-standing laws that are having you're having trouble enforcing those, whether it's illegal fees or clean water standards or whatever. So, you know, I would question whether adding some new standard or aspirational thing is actually going to help you that, or perhaps the focus should be on trying to deal with the current violations of law.
I mean, can you expand maybe on some kind of, you know, some of the ideas of how?
Well, going back to, I believe, Mr. Loftus's question of several minutes ago, you know, when the with the 13th, 14th, 15th Amendment were passed, much of that, well, at least with regard to the 14th and 15th Amendment, ended up becoming it's a constitutional provision, but it ended up becoming dead letter for the better part of a century. And that's is, I would say, because rights, however enshrined and however lawfully created, they're just going to be paper rights unless they're backed up by democracy and institutional structures that help people actually, you know, be able to demand them. And so, you know, those are sorts of the institutional, political structure. You know, if the government is, you know, if Rick Schneider or whoever is lying or violating the law or whatever, you need to work on changing that, as opposed to just thinking that creating
creating
a
new
human
laws
right somewhere
that enforce the laws in place.
Right. Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah, I'm curious how you use water now, like how you go through a day. Like when you think, you said there's so many things that you do with water that you don't even think about until it's taken away. And I'm curious if you just kind of walk us through how you use water now.
Yes. I use water for everything. I have to rinse off my vegetables in water. I have to boil water to cook my rice. My son and my daughter, we keep water in the bathroom. We have to brush our teeth with water.
Is it all bottles now?
Yes, all bottles. They give out gallons some places too, but I use the bottled water because it's more convenient to me than pouring gallon after gallon, which it seems like it's not convenient pouring one bottle at a time. But I was using it to bathe, but it was like so time consuming pouring all of that water, then having to add hot water and add more water. So I take a bath, but it's really not safe for us taking a bath, inhaling all of them heavy metals and all of that neither. So I'm in the shower 5 minutes and out, and then it's not hot water. It's like lukewarm water.
So for everything else you're using?
I go through probably over 100 and something cases a day.
How much is that?
I mean, not cases, 100 and something bottles. I'm sorry.
How much is that? Because is there still one water pod open? Or how many? Or
no, all the pods
have
closed.
All closed now.
Yeah, they have all closed.
No,
I'm not buying them right now. And I've actually had someone from another state, a pastor, had got a hold to me on Facebook, and she like sends it from Mississippi to Walmart here, so I just have to go pick it up. So every month she sends me and my kids water. But if not, I would be buying water, which paying for poison water bill plus water, that is ridiculous. We were poisoned, did not bring this on ourselves, but then we have to fix it, and we're the community. It's ridiculous what the federal and the state is getting away with here in Flint. If this was in Grosse Pointe, anywhere else, this would have been fixed. But because of the low poverty, majority African-American, they're not doing anything. They don't care about us. It was money over lives here in Flint.
Yes.
Yeah, so I'm a journalism student at MSU, and let me know if my question is stupid. But
no questions are stupid.
So I'm listening to a lot of, you know, litigation and proceedings and all these types of, so quote-unquote solutions, but
But what can we all do? Like, maybe everyone can have something.
Well, Nakia, do you want to tackle that one? I have a few ideas, but...
I really don't even know how to tackle that one. Like I said, it's been over 1,600 days, and we're still fighting for water here.
Yeah.
I don't want to say keep sending bottled water, because, I mean, this is a Band-Aid. We've been on this for 1,600 days. We don't need no more bottled water.
Yeah.
We need our infrastructure. We need our whole house. We need...
Or water buffaloes.
Right.
Right. In each home. None of that was ever given to us here. On top of that, the CDC tells us it's safe to bathe in our water because they have no data telling them otherwise. Because they ignore the European data available saying it's not safe to bathe in water with lead.
The company's subsidy taken effect yesterday. I can't remember who. There's at least 13 individuals who are being charged right now that are undergoing trial, and that's going on every single day. It's hard to keep track of the schedule, but yesterday Dr. Laura Sullivan was in court to testify against the MDEQ and the Department of Health and Human Services. We need to follow those court cases for those individuals and make sure that they are tried.
Right.
And make sure that those cases go to trial and completely, and that they're not dismissed out of hand. We need to make sure that Nick Lyon and Eden Wells and Darnell Early and Jerry Ambrose and all the individuals who are charged with involuntary manslaughter for killing people and the Legionnaires' disease, that those cases keep up. Yeah, in the public, that they're reported and they're followed, so that it's a waiting game right now. They're waiting for us to take our eyes off and to just dismiss those charges.
Right.
And they're trying to take it out of the city. They're trying to try it in the UP. So we need media coverage of those 13 cases in particular, and we need more pressure so that more people are charged with these crimes. Going up to Rick Snyder, he needs to be held accountable. And that insult to injury, we're paying taxpayers right now, paying for Rick Snyder's criminal defense, and we're also paying his public relations firm to gloss over all of these facts. So the initial media response was actually getting the story from Rick Snyder's public relations. Anything that's went forward, you'll see a lot of billboards up, that's coming from the Snyder administration. So you've got to make sure where your information is coming from, and that it's not coming from Snyder. So those are some concrete things that need to be done, you know, in the media that would actually be very, very effective.
Eric, did you have a couple more
points? Yeah, my two points would be, one is, I think the folks in this room, I think the press coverage is really critical to keeping this issue in the forefront of people's minds. It really, until it started getting national and international coverage, the issue just was not going anywhere. Not that it's been solved, but I think as the press coverage has receded, a lot of people just have assumed, as Nikki was saying, that everything's fine, it's all finished, there's nothing to worry about, which cannot be farther from the truth. So I think that's key.
Yes.
Nakia and others, maybe this is another way of saying it. I'm Tom Henry from the Toledo Blade, and we experienced, you know, the Toledo water crisis 4 years ago from an algal toxin, which at the time was international news, and you guys have certainly far exceeded the problem there. My point is, though, our mayor, our late mayor who took us through that, he told me it was a crisis of confidence. We lost confidence of the people, you know, in local government, and we have to fight them back. I did a story looking at Milwaukee and the cryptosporidium many, like 20, 25 years ago. They're still trying to recover from that. Our business community is wondering, are we going to be branded as LG City every summer when people are so nervous about that? So I'm asking you, I know this is a crystal ball type thing. Given how badly you guys have been burned, and there's obviously racial connotations here, like you said. To me, when I came up and covered, I told my boss the only thing I can say, the only word that comes to mind is offensive. How could you do this to people, you know, in our country? So what do you think it's going to take for you folks to regain confidence in local government?
That's a hard question for me to answer, because like I've said, it's been so long.
Even today in Toledo, we have people who don't, my wife included, who prefer bottled water over our tap water. Tap water is perfectly fine, at least the test results show that. We don't have a lead pipe problem that you do by and large, except for some old homes probably, but I'm just saying the psychology of water, people, it just seems to be once you lose that, it's very hard to get it back. And in your case, I can't imagine how hard it would be to ever get confidence. Because people all around the world are asking, when are we going to fix Flint, and when are things going to go back to quote unquote normal for them?
Right. That's why I said that's a very hard question for me to answer. I don't know what it would really take. Like I said, I've went through two horrible miscarriages, not one, but two, twins, both times. Now I'm worried. I don't even know if my daughter, who is 19, will be able to have grandchildren because she was also drinking this water. So I don't know what it would take for me to trust the government, really.
I can't.
So like it's not a matter of like when are we going to trust it. Well, it's not even fixed yet, so there's nothing to trust, and I'm kind of tired of the question, actually. You know, I think that question is offensive. When are we going to trust? Well, there's nothing trustworthy yet. So, well, or maybe another way of putting it is, how do you feel? What has it done to the community psyche? You know, just your everyday operation, it's got to be depressing as hell. Yes, you know?
It is.
What do you do to cope with not just the fact you have bad water that's questionable, but to deal with this anxiety that you must have every day?
Me, for one, like I said, I have children, so I just cannot just, like, give up. I'm going to keep fighting till we get justice. I'm going to keep fighting until they get Snyder and everybody. Everyone has to be held accountable. I feel like if I was the governor, me being African-American, I would have been had charges. Just like Donnell Early. He was the first one. He's African-American. Everyone needs to be held accountable for their actions. There has been deaths. The mayor of Detroit is locked up, incarcerated for 20 years for embezzlements. There has been 13 deaths in Flint, and everybody is trying to get cases dismissed. They should be incarcerated. I've lost children behind this. They should be incarcerated.
We're coming to the end. If anyone had anything burning on the panel that they wanted to say, or one short question, otherwise I think we're have to wrap up.
Just one important point, which is that Flint still doesn't really have local government, right? I mean, still have government imposed by the state. So, you know, to regain trust in local government that has no power is a serious question.
They have more power than, when they were on total emergency management.
Yes, they do, than when they were completely under the control of the state. But there's still a lot of external control on what happens in Flint. So I think it's a failure of democracy in many ways we honestly, Flint is not the only example of this, but it's certainly an extreme one where democracy is not responded. And I think, without significant additional press coverage and public attention and voting people out of office that aren't doing their jobs, you're not going to solve this problem.
Right. So without the strengthening of democracy, like water is a human right, or these extra laws might not.
Right.
I mean, more coverage on the financial emergency manager law.
Right.
Because one of the fears is that we've been exporting cars, for decades. That's what we're known for. And we're going to be known for exporting the financial emergency manager law. Because if it starts going to other states, this is just going to happen elsewhere as well. So please do coverage on that. We need to completely eliminate it, all of its forms. And it needs to be followed up on. And it's hard because it's not a sexy topic at all, but it really does need to be covered.
Thank you. Thank you very much for coming. Thank you.